Brian Civic is the former Chief Technology Officer at the Department of Health and Human Services and here to discuss the Idea Lab and Buyers Club concepts. Brian, thank you very much for joining me today. It's great to see you. What was the genesis, first with the Idea Lab, and what were you trying to do with that? What problem were you trying to solve when you stood that up? Thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and great question. So really, the way it all kind of went down was that when I got to HHS about 3 years ago, we had in place a couple of programs that were designed to extract some sort of innovation potential from the folks in the department. Things like HHS Innovates, which is a recognition program for the folks in the agency or across the department, and another one or two, but they weren't really very connected. It was sort of ad hoc, and so we sat down and thought for a while about what we could accomplish that would be more of a sort of systematic process and program. And we actually went out and talked to a bunch of people across the department and asked them what the specific challenges were that they were facing and how we could potentially help to solve some of those problems for them. And really what came out of it were three major areas that we could work in. Number one, we realized we needed to figure out how to take better advantage of the 90,000 or so full-time employees that we have at the department. And, you know, you'll know, and I'm sure the audience listening will know better than anybody out there, we've got some of the best people I've ever worked with in my life in government. These are folks who are, you know, certainly not there for the money. They're there for the mission. They're incredibly dedicated to what they're doing. They're for the most part, incredibly intelligent, you know, just focused, but they have a hard time sometimes trying to take their ideas and experiment with them in different contexts. And so that was the first thing. The second thing that we realized is that even though we have all these great employees, there's still plenty of skills and experiences that we don't have within the department that we need in order to solve some of the big problems, some of the complex challenges. And so we needed to figure out how to bring people in for time-limited periods in order to work on solving some of these problems. And then third, and this is maybe not limited to government, although it is a big problem in government, we have lots of silos, and they're silos both vertically and horizontally. When you look at the concept and the history of sort of innovative development or innovative thought, what you realize is that no new idea is developed in a vacuum. The eureka moment is kind of a myth. Mm-hmm. Typically speaking, people have these new ideas and new thoughts when they're working together with different people with different backgrounds and different cultures and different experiences, and all of those things are brought to bear in order to solve problems. So the third piece was that we needed to come up with a way to kind of break down some of these barriers and create collaborative communities across the department in order to solve some of these big cross-cutting challenges. Mm-hmm. We sort of iterated over this, these concepts over a while, and eventually we came up with the concept of building this thing out called the Idea Lab, which would be a physical home and sort of a spiritual home, if you will, for the solutions to these problems. And in each one of those three categories, we have a set of initiatives, or we developed a set of initiatives that would, the goal of those initiatives were to address those three challenges.
The thing about those three areas that's fascinating to me is that the first two are dramatically impacted already by the third one. Taking advantage of the knowledge of the employees, many times what you hear about when folks say they have ideas, it's because of the silos is the reason that they say, I can't get it up the chain, I can't spread it. And the same thing bringing in the talent. A lot of times that's a silo issue and a process and procedure issue. How did you decide, or why did you decide to break that one out as a separate one worthy of work and attack, I guess, rather than working through the others? I'm just curious as to the genesis of that.
No, that's fair. In a sense, I would say that they're all sort of correlated, mm-hmm. right? There are touch points between all three of these areas of effort. And the initiatives that exist underneath all three are sort of tied together in a certain way. But I think it's important enough to focus on creating these sort of collaborative communities across large bureaucratic organizations as a thing into and of itself that it's worthy of separating it out. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it, so the federal government and, I mean, many governments and many large organizations for that matter are very... they've grown up over the 20th century, right? They're very hierarchical, command and control oriented, sort of very process driven. And it's hard sometimes to break out of those sort of those buckets when you're trying to actually accomplish something. So if we can provide mechanisms that allow people to say safely, I'll use the word safe in a, you know, sort of bureaucratic context, work together to accomplish something interesting, then you can imagine how some of those other things can be solved. Now, when you think about those three areas of focus, what I would say is that they're also in some sense scoped to different levels of effort across the department. So the first area where we're taking advantage of the, trying to take better advantage of the full-time employees that we have at the department, we're really focused there on sort of smaller ideas that directly affect a specific mission, but that can be executed with a small team. The second area, bringing people in from the outside, tend to focus more on more complex issues that are, you know, sort of divisional in nature. And then the third area is much broader. And The idea is that we want to spool things up that really touch every part of the department as a whole. So you can kind of imagine them as a, you know, a funnel sort of progressively growing wider throughout those three buckets as well.
So you kind of, I guess, anticipated my next question, which is after you determined that these were the three areas you wanted to focus on, did you start on each of them at the same time, or was there some kind of a prioritization or progression of it? It sounds like you wanted to move forward on all of them at the same time and could do them simultaneously.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mentioned that there were a few things in place when I got there. Mm-hmm. HHS Innovates was the very first thing that was really kicked off, and this is the internal employee recognition program, which obviously fit very nicely in that first bucket, right? If we can recognize people for actually trying to do new things, then obviously we're encouraging this idea of experimentation and iteration and hopefully sort of valuing the contributions of people who are taking a chance more than they have been in the past. In the second category, actually, something that we kicked off right when I got there was something called the Entrepreneur in Residence Program. And this is where we bring people in from the outside world for a period of no more than a year to work on some complex, quote unquote, high risk, high reward issues within divisions of the department. And then the third thing that was in place when I got there was the Health Data Initiative, which obviously was something that was started about 5 years ago. And if you think about what the Health Data Initiative really is, it's a program run out of the CTO's office, but really made up of volunteers from across the department at all levels of the department who are very motivated by and jazzed by getting HHS data out of HHS and making it publicly available in machine-readable formats for academics and researchers and entrepreneurs and developers to do interesting things with, to try to fundamentally understand the healthcare and human services systems better or to fundamentally change them in different ways. So there was a foundation already in place sort of for each one of those three areas. But again, they weren't really tied together. So what the Idea Lab did was tie those together. We kept focus on those three areas and then built a few more programs within each category to kind of address different elements of that specific category. So in the first one, we built the HHS Ignite Accelerator, which you can think of as a sort of 3-month Silicon Valley style accelerator. We basically, teams apply. It's highly selective, actually. Over the first three rounds of the, or three classes, I should say, of the accelerator, we had about 250 applications and we selected 35 teams. Mm-hmm. They are given up to $5,000. And a boatload of mentorship and training and things that people in government very rarely get mentorship and training on. So rapid design and prototyping techniques, human-centered design and design thinking, lean startup, you know, all this kind of stuff. And actually, what's one just side note, what's interesting about that is the money is actually the least important part. Many of the teams never used a dime of the money, right? The mentoring and the training was the most important. So we built that. We built a small venture fund, the idea being that if you go through the accelerator and you know, your idea shows promise but hasn't quite gotten there yet, we can actually leverage some other funds and some other effort, mentorship, et cetera, to kind of bring it to the next level, to get it to the point where it can scale or to prove that it doesn't work. And then in the second bucket, we also built something called the Innovator in Residence Program, which is different from the Entrepreneur in Residence in that with the Innovator in Residence Program, we essentially partner with a nonprofit that had a similar topical interest to somewhere at HHS. And we then, that nonprofit funds a 2-year position within the department. And we go out and find some crazy, awesome innovator to come in and really, you know, think about what can be done in that particular area. One neat thing about it is that we do not define the specific problem. We just say, here's a topic that we're interested in seeing something happen in. And it's up to the person who comes in to kind of do a walkabout, understand the scope of the area, and then figure out what's the project or projects, what are they going to be for the next 2 years, and mm-hmm. what value those things are going to add. That's the second bucket. And then in the third bucket, we had the Health Data Initiative. On top of that, one that we added was something called the Buyers Club, the HHS Buyers Club, which the idea there is to basically try to fix IT procurement across government. And obviously, this is something, if you're going to make it work, requires lots of people from across the department to break down some walls and get together and try to do things in different ways. And so, you know, there are a few other examples in there, but those are the real major ones that we spent time focusing on and building out that, you know, are going strong today.
I want to talk more about the Buyers Club when we continue our conversation. But a note that I made about the Entrepreneur in Residence program, and you talked about it a little bit when you were talking about the three major focus areas, the second one being bringing in talent from outside the agency on short-term appointments. I wonder if that time frame, the fact that there's a definitive time frame, you're going to be here for X amount of time, makes it more or less attractive to somebody to come in from outside government and take on a big challenge as you would like them to do?
So I actually think it's more attractive. The kinds of people that we're recruiting for these are people who would, I think, rarely think, I want to go work for the government, mm-hmm. right? They're getting paid lots of money in Silicon Valley or, you know, some other company or doing whatever. And why would they want to take a pay cut and, you know, deal with the craziness of Washington, D.C. and the federal bureaucracy to actually do something? So I think that, you know, time period, that restriction actually adds to the value. But the other thing that restriction, time restriction does is it changes the fundamental way that people approach solving the problem. If you only have 12 months to do something, you kind of, by definition, have to do something in a different way than we typically do, mm-hmm. right? And so what happens is these people come in and, you know, since they're focused on getting something done in 12 months, the first question they're going to ask if somebody says, well, you have to go do this, 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 and this is why? And is there a better way? Mm-hmm. And they can ask that question. A lot of times people, you know, who've been long-time career government employees really don't feel like they can. And so what's been fascinating, and actually, frankly, one of the goals of the program is to really allow the career federal employees to see that it's possible, right? And to give them that sort of knowledge and assurance that they actually can ask why, and they can challenge a process and say, you know what, there might be a better way to do something. And so we feel like if we can bring some successes to bear, and they work very, very closely with the host internal team, we can bring some of those successes to bear, then everybody wins, not just for the short term, but also for the long term.
So the Buyers Club concept worked sufficiently well that Anne Rung said at an event I was at last week that every agency would stand one up. We mentioned, you said before we went on the air that you're struck by the name and the fact that the name has stuck and has kind of become the conceptual name for what's going on. Tell me about the cultural response to the idea that this organization, this Idea Lab that was a little bit unusual and different from the way everything else was done, was going to be taking on this huge mission of changing the way that IT is acquired, being led by the CTO of the agency, not by the CIO or by somebody in the acquisition department or something like that. Was there a response, either positive or negative, to that when this first kind of got around?
That's a great question. So I'm kind of chuckling to it. Your mention of the name, the Idea Lab in concept is a little unusual for government in general, and so we tried to emphasize some of that by naming things in interesting and compelling ways. And actually, one of the guys on my team, Greg Downing, came up with the name, and it was so perfect for what we were trying to do. It just stuck, especially given, you know, the Dallas Buyers Club mm-hmm. and the movie had come out, and it was all about like the federal, you know, stuff. Yep. Actually, a funny anecdote, just as a side note. When we were first developing the concept, I went over to FDA to kind of talk to some of their senior leadership about it. And one of the lawyers was in the room, and I said, so listen, I want to talk to you guys about this thing we're calling the HHS Buyers Club. And I talked about it for a few minutes, and one of these lawyers looked at me and goes, you know, Brian, we really don't like the name Buyers Club around here. And I was like, oh, I forgot. I totally forgot about the, you know, the history of the movie and everything else. But it was sort of a joke anyway. It's not, you know, it didn't kill it in its tracks or anything
right.
like that.
Obviously not.
Everybody got a little bit of a chuckle out of it. But the so the general concept behind the Buyers Club and the way it started is actually, I think, it's an interesting story. So everybody will remember October 1st, 2013, not just for the government shutdown, but also for the launch of the first version of healthcare.gov, which needless to say, did not necessarily go very well.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that came out of that was a report that I read maybe 2 weeks later by a group called the Stanish Group, which basically said that 94% of all federal IT projects over $10 million fails. They said 40% fail because they never launch, and the other 54% fail because they're either over time, over budget, or when they do launch, they don't do what they're supposed to do. Whether you believe that number or not, and 94% seems a little high to me, to be perfectly honest, but even if that number is 40% or 50%, right, it's still way too high. And so, you know, we looked at that and we said, you know, I think there's a better way. I think we can do procurement differently. And we started looking into it then. We'd been looking into this for a long time, and I think a lot of other people across the government have realized that there were issues. One of the sort of next interesting things that happened was the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy on the sort of under Tom Khalil and his people actually came out with a, in partnership with OFPP, actually came out with a wonderful document called it was just a draft, and it wasn't widely circulated. It was just sort of like, you know, hey, can a few people take a look at this to see what you think? It was all about these sort of innovative contracting case studies, right? Different department or agencies across the government that had tried to buy things in different ways and succeeded, and here's how they did it, and here are the mechanisms they used and all this. And I read that, and I thought, wow, this is really good, right? There's a lot of stuff in here that's incredibly useful for the procurement community, first of all, but also for the program management community. The problem is nobody was ever going to read that. And if they did, they weren't going to be able to take action on it because, you know, you're a busy procurement guy or gal, and you've got all these things that you need to do and a time frame in which you need to do them. You know, asking you to read a 100-page document and say, oh, I understand how I can apply this new procurement to this technique and all this stuff, it just doesn't happen, right? So we said, well, what if we could create a mechanism within the Idea Lab that would, first of all, in some easy way, help a busy procurement person walk through almost like a flowchart that said, if your thing looks like this, you know, try these things over here, A. And B, along with those sort of those materials, provide HHS-specific examples that we could, you know, we could run the procurements and run them through some of these innovative ideas to prove that they were possible and to identify what things needed to be tweaked and what things worked well and all of that kind of stuff. So we started socializing the idea around HHS. As you would imagine and as you kind of alluded to, there was some resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't our job. It's not something that, you know, we're working on.
Right.
You know, it's a little sacrilegious to propose a change to the way you procure things, right? But we had, frankly, the failure of healthcare.gov, which was, you know, I mean, this has been analyzed many times, so we don't need to go into it, but, you know, had some silver linings associated with it. And B, this report and this document from the White House that actually was pretty good with some existing examples. And then, you know, C, I think we had a real desire and willingness to do something different. And so we had lots and lots of conversations. One of the things that we realized was that in order to do this the right way, we needed somebody who knew procurement on the team that could be both sort of respected by the community and that kind of knew the details. Cause you know, I'm not a procurement guy. I don't know. I know what the FAR is. I don't know what the FAR really says. Right. And so, we went down and we actually found, sort of accidentally, a very progressive young procurement guy, down at CDC, named Mark Nagar, who was looking to do something different. We brought him up on a detail to start this thing off, and eventually he became a full-time employee. But it's been really fascinating, you know, taking that original White House document and some other artifacts and crafting those into something that others can use, building sort of new examples of procurements. And there's a new one that just got announced the other day. that are sort of just examples of different ways that things can be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe most importantly, and this is something that I think I knew sort of conceptually, but didn't quite realize as fundamental, that it was as fundamental of an issue as it was. In traditional sort of procurement land, you've got the program side who spends a lot of time coming up with this massive RFP with all these requirements and, you know, everything else. They toss it over the wall to the procurement folks. The clock starts ticking. A procurement action happens in the time span of that clock. A vendor is selected, and then it's tossed back over the wall to the program, and off they go. And the problem with that is that nobody's incentives are actually really aligned to accomplish the same thing. And so one of the most important artifacts of this whole thing, from my perspective, is that we've actually been able to, in certain cases, bring all of these communities, the program people, the procurement people, and the lawyers together in order to, you know, work from day one on a solicitation that has the eventual sort of goal of not just picking a vendor, but actually implementing something successful at the end. And so we're trying to align everybody's incentives, breaking down those barriers, creating this community, and helping people do things in different ways.
So my colleague Jason Miller has a terrific story on federalnewsradio.com that's based on a conversation with Mark. And the title of the story is HHS Buyers Club Proving a Non-Traditional IT Acquisition Approach Works. So I imagine a lot of the goals that you've just described have been met not only in Jason's eyes, but in the eyes of other folks who are watching the Buyers Club. And we have a link to that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth to learn more about the execution of what Brian is talking about. As you move forward on this, and as Mark continues the work that you've started, and that Susanna Fox continues the work that you've started, eventually their times, Susanna's especially, will come to an end at HHS. How do you suggest that the principles that you've laid out here become institutionalized so that this doesn't disappear at the end of an administration or the end of a particular executive's tenure?
It's a great question. We thought a lot, and I assume the team continues to think a lot about sustainability. So this was my third government job. My first two were the CIO of Washington, D.C., and then the Chief Innovation Officer in Maryland. And in both places now, I've seen work that we did kind of get tossed out, you know, the baby gets tossed out with the bathwater kind of thing when a new administration comes in. Not because they're bad ideas or mm-hmm. because they don't work. It's just because, you know, either it's a different set of priorities or it's not the right focus or, you know, simply sometimes it's just the other guy's thing. Right. And so there were a couple of things that we have sort of embarked on in order to hopefully ensure sustainability. Number one, I think it's a lot harder to kill something if there's a physical entity involved, if there's actually like a space mm-hmm. and there are people in the space, you know, and they're working on things that are associated with that entity. So frankly, that was one of the motivations behind creating this thing called the Idea Lab and actually giving it a permanent home. Secondly, as part of the president's FY16 budget request, there's actually a line item now in that budget request for funding this entity, which obviously gives it a more sort of sustainability and hopefully that will come through. You know, the idea of creating something that is fundamentally nonpartisan, right? This is not a democratic idea, right? This is just a good management idea. And it's a, you know, a set of practices that's designed to make government work better and more efficiently, which you would think would be amenable to both Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, I think there are those things going in its favor.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you know, the tendency for people to come in and not recognize the value of an asset or to simply say, like I said, it's the other guy's thing, you know, it happens. And so I people ask me this question all the time. And my answer is I don't know, you know, I can't guarantee you one way or another that this will stick around. Maybe, you know, it'll modify itself in a different administration to help serve the purposes of whatever new administration comes in. I really do hope though, that I hope that whoever comes in next sees it as a wonderful platform and a foundation to build on that will help them execute their ideas in new and different ways, right? To me, if that's the lasting effect, then I will feel like we've really made an important contribution.
I mentioned the comments that Anne Rung made last week talking about the perpetuation of the Buyers Club concept all across government. She was very clear to point out, though, when I asked her, is this going to be a duplication of what Brian and his team did at HHS? And she said, no, every agency will have the latitude to create a similar mechanism that works for them. What pieces of what you did worked for HHS and might not work someplace else? And what pieces of what you did are pretty much required for doing something similar at someplace else?
So the first thing I would say is that it's a work in progress. Using the phrase or the formulation "did" right as past tense, I think is probably not the right way to think about it. It's literally one of the things that we actually were very very explicit about is that we put a beta label on everything, right? Literally everything, because the point is we're going to rapidly iterate and experiment with all of these different programs because we know we're not going to get it right the first time. So even, the Buyers Club in the first year of its existence has morphed in a lot of different ways. And I think we'll continue to do so over time. So I would say, if anything, that's number one, right? Start small, start focused, have a very specific idea in mind that's relevant for your particular entity. Call it beta and see what happens, right? And don't be afraid to say that thing didn't work, but we're going to try this other thing because we think it might work better.
Mm-hmm.
I think for us, the idea of providing and building this collateral and material was important to help busy program and procurement people and lawyers see different ways of doing things. And I also think that it was incredibly important to break down the walls between these different groups. My guess is that those two things are going to be valuable pretty much everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But, different departments and agencies have very different structures and very different personalities and very different people. And the mechanisms by which we went about soliciting procurements to work on and creating the collateral and getting people involved might not work as well in other places. And that's totally fine. I think that that's where those are the areas where a lot of iteration and flexibility are important. So if I were called into, Department of Commerce or whatever, right? And they said, hey, we want to build one of these things. My advice to them would be find a respected and, forward-thinking procurement person who's not willing or who's not afraid to challenge the status quo and to ask the question why and to push, where things people might not have pushed before. Give that person some resources, because it's hard to do it alone. And then focus maybe on looking for a couple of quick win procurements where the people who are on the program side, kind of understand the value and are willing to try something different. Sink your teeth into those, get those done. Along the way, you'll start building up this network of people within the agency or department that really get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes your sort of force multiplier going forward, right? That's usually how I would recommend starting, but the details of how you do that are going to be very individual, I think, at each of the different departments. And that's the beauty of what I think Anne is really talking about. There, I've seen plenty of things from the White House over the last few years where they've been very, rote for every single department,
yeah,
and every single agency. And as you know, those tend to not work very well because they do have different cultures and personalities and histories and all that kind of stuff that you really do have to take into account.
So I'll go back to what you were talking about when you discussed the three major areas that you focused on. And the step before that was to essentially, I wrote down the words customer focus. You went out and talked to your customers inside the agency and said, what's going on here? And what are the areas that you really need some support, some help on? And it seems to me that would be the best homework/forcing function for somebody who's going to do this the same way that you did it. Start the same place you did and let that activity take you wherever it takes you. Is that a fair
read
on my part?
Absolutely. And if you look at some of the most successful companies out there, they spend a lot of time actually talking to their users, right? Talking to their customers. And I shouldn't say companies, I should say organizations, right? Mm-hmm. They really understand what their users/customers are looking for, what the challenges are, what the problems are that need to be solved, all of that kind of stuff. And I think in government, we sometimes can put up a little bit of a barrier between the institution and the people that institution is meant to serve. You know, people sometimes are afraid it might look somewhat improprietous to have conversations, or they might be, you know, sort of cowed by lawyers who threaten, you know, that these kinds of things are not allowed or what have you. But it's my belief that you can only design a good product or service for people if you actually have those people really involved in the design and development of that product or service. And so a lot of the things, just as an example, in the Ignite Accelerator, one of the main things we teach right off the bat during a 3-day boot camp is to say, hey, look, you know, get out there and talk to your users, because if you do not have these user conversations, these customer conversations, you will never know that you're building the right thing, and you'll waste the 3 months building something that's not right. And we've got great examples of where people have sort of, you know, had an idea, had some conversations, all of a sudden realized that that idea wouldn't work and completely pivoted to something else. It's really remarkable.
Is the art of success in all of these areas then that pivot that you just talked about, to be able to see it, I won't say failure, see a challenge coming and be able to anticipate it and pivot?
Yeah, but don't be afraid of the word failure. I mean, okay. So think about it this way. I love the word experiment. I love the word experimentation. And the reason I love that word is because it does two things. Number one, it sort of says, well, I'm gonna undergo a process, right? I'm going to develop a hypothesis, test that hypothesis, generate some metrics, and use those metrics to see whether the hypothesis was valid or not. But the other thing it does is it encodes this idea of an unsuccessful experiment, which in experimentation is perfectly okay, right? The government is bad at failing, quote unquote, but really should be okay with experimentation, right? Because it's only through iteration, through experimentation, that we're going to arrive at the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
I guarantee you that, I mean, look at any law that's passed or any regulation that's ever been written, right? The first iteration, or maybe even the 10th iteration of those things, are never the right ones, right? But our system is very rigid and sort of inflexible in terms of rapidly iterating on ideas. And that's one area where I think that if we could bring more of this philosophy into the universe, we would actually have a government that's much more proactive instead of reactive, much more responsive, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
The word experiment connotes that it's possible it might not work that's from right. The very beginning, and sets that up in the minds of the people who are thinking about
that's
it.
That's exactly right.
Brian, a terrific conversation. I congratulate you on the success that this is having, and I thank you very much for helping us understand it better as it starts to spread out to agencies across government.
No, my pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.